Hello and welcome back to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong and includes everything from 21st century classics such as Mulholland Drive and Four Lions, international favourites such as A Prophet and Train to Busan, and comedy gems like LA Story and School for Scoundrels. And we're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. Along the way, we flag up new releases and re-releases, films you might have seen, films you might not have seen, but hopefully we'll be adding a movie or two to your watch list as we go. Across previous episodes, we've explored Apocalypse Now, The Railway Children, The Third Man, and the work of Arnold Schwarzenegger. This time, well, we're delving into French New Wave cinema, and in particular, Jean-Luc Godard's debut feature, Breathless. Here's some music just to set the scene.
New York Herald Tribune! Monte Carlo?
Non, de Marseille. Je suis resté samedi et dimanche à Monte Carlo. Fallait que je voie un type. Lundi, j'ai essayé de t'appeler de Marseille.
Lundi et dimanche, je n'étais pas à Paris. New York Herald Tribune!
Je t'en prends un.
C'est gentil.
That's a clip from Breathless, or A Bout de Souffle, Jean-Luc Godard's groundbreaking 1960 debut film starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg. Now, in a little while, you're going to hear me talking to LA-based critic and filmmaker Drew Gregory, who discovered Breathless and a passion for the French New Wave at the age of just 14. But first, I'm joined by French-born, British-based writer, critic and professor of film studies at King's College London, Jeanette Vincendeau. And just like Jean-Luc Godard, she got into film as a result of going to see a film in Paris. In this case, a film a friend described as the best film ever made. So what was that film? What was the turning point for you, Jeanette?
It was a film called The Rules of the Game, La Règle du Jeu by Jean Renoir. And it is indeed one of the best films ever made. I think it deserves that title. But at the time, I thought my heart sank a bit when I was told, you must love this because it's a masterpiece. But it's going to Cinémathèque in Paris in the early 70s that got me into film. And in a way, it's almost like a cliche today to say that because, of course, that's how the New Wave filmmakers got into film, by watching films at the Cinémathèque. So I feel, I mean, honoured to be in that tradition.
So you mentioned there the Cinémathèque, and that was part and parcel of what became known as the French New Wave. And I just wonder, can you set the scene for us? Can you tell us what the French New Wave was for those who've not heard of it before or don't quite get what it is?
Well, the French New Wave is a film movement that started in the late 1950s with films by François Truffaut, Alain René, Claude Chabrol and Jean-Luc Godard. With Breathless. But what was special about it is that these filmmakers first started as critics. And they started as film critics in a way which was very unusual at the time.
Yeah.
So to understand the emergence of the New Wave, you have to place yourself in Paris after the war. And it's a period after the German occupation of France where the French film industry becomes much more organized, partly thanks to the Germans, and then the hold of the unions at the time. So it becomes much more professionalized.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there is a new film culture emerging at the Cinémathèque Française, the French Film Archive, basically, which started in the 30s. But after the war, it showed a lot of American films that had been banned during the war, you know, all these wonderful film noir and so on. And there was a group of young men watching these films and being completely overwhelmed by them. And unlike the more established filmmakers in the French film industry, they didn't have the traditional training. Their training was watching films, basically, and then writing about them. So they first became film critics, writing for journals like Les Cahiers du Cinéma, and then through that writing, became interested in making films. their position was very polemical. It was a kind of Oedipal rebellion against the father figures of French cinema. And although they recognize a few masters like Jean Renoir, for example, mostly they wanted to make films differently.
I mean, when I first hear a term such as New Wave or something like that, my question tends to be also, what's the old wave? What is the rebellion against?
The rebellion was against the establishment of French cinema at the time. Yeah. What they called the tradition of quality. Films that were actually wonderful. And so in a way, they managed to turn the word quality into a term of abuse to say, you know, the tradition of quality films by people like René Clair, Henri-Georges Clouzot, Claude Autant-Lara, were actually wonderful films, extremely well made, beautiful photography. They're usually made in a studio with very well constructed stories, you know, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Yeah. And they wanted something which would be more spontaneous. And to achieve that, they had to break the rules. So that new wave, the basis of it is breaking the rules of that established, well-made tradition of quality cinema.
But how easy was that to do? Because if we talk about a modern filmmaker now wanting to push against something, they'll pick up a smartphone. The equipment is right in their hands. But what about back in like the late 1950s when they were starting thinking about doing these films?
You're right that it was, of course, difficult. It was more difficult than it would be today. But they were helped by the fact that there were changes in the technology. So lighter cameras were being made, sound equipment that was easier to carry around and so on. And so one of their credos of the New Wave was to shoot films on location, to do away with the studio. Yeah. And so New Wave films are immediately recognizable compared to the established cinema, French cinema of the time, because they shot on the street, they shot in real apartments, in really pokey rooms and so on. Of course, one of the great paradoxes was at the same time, they adored American cinema and they adored American studio cinema. But the French studio cinema is what they wanted to do away with. They wanted to make films, of course, that were cheaper as well. And they got producers interested in financing those new kinds of films that realized also you could make a film with a small budget and in some cases, like Breathless, make money. Of course, not always, but in some cases it worked. And also an important thing was that the mainstream traditional quality French films used big stars, you know, people like Jean Gabin, Michel Morgan, and they said, well, we don't want to use these stars. And Truffaut has a famous phrase saying, I will never use Jean Gabin, I will never use Michel Morgan, and so on. Of course, partly it's because they could not afford them. So they created their own stars. Yeah. People like Jean-Paul Belmondo, Anna Karina, who was Godard's wife, who appeared in a lot of his films after Breathless. It's a new look to the films and also new performances and also new types of characters, a modernity in the cinema.
You've set the foundation for how the French New Wave came into being and the people who fueled it. But specifically, what was it that sparked Breathless in particular into life?
Well, it was partly a team effort. Truffaut had something to do with the script. What's interesting when one thinks of Breathless today as possibly the most iconic French New Wave film is that it actually came rather late. Truffaut, René Chabrol, they all got films out in 1959.
Yeah.
And Godard only started shooting Breathless in the summer of 59 and came out in the spring of 1960. So he took a little bit longer than the others, but he got there. And it's a film about Paris. It's a film about love and romance in Paris. It's also a tribute to American cinema. And that is also very typical of Godard as a critic as well. His adoration for American film, you can see in the film in all sorts of ways. Of course, first of all, with Jean Seberg playing the female lead in the film, an American star. And for Godard, this was paying tribute to the films of Otto Preminger, in which she had appeared in Hollywood. Also, in the film, there's a wonderful scene, which possibly is my favorite scene in the whole movie. Jean-Paul Belmondo stands in front of a poster of Humphrey Bogart.
Yes, yes.
And sort of looks dreamily at him and says, Bogey, and there's kind of smoke drifting across the frame. It kind of says it all, I think.
Bogey.
But at the same time, and I think that's what made the film also so popular, it's in Paris, and it's not, I think, by chance, Godard chose some of very iconic images of Paris, you know, the Champs-Élysées, Place de la Concorde, Montparnasse. So as soon as we get to Paris, we are on the Champs-Élysées and the first meeting on screen of Belmondo and Jean Seberg. It really works because it is the Champs-Élysées, and you can see that they are walking on the Champs-Élysées. Yeah. It's not a sort of a retro projection. It's they're there. And in fact, when you look carefully at the film, if you watch it again and again, you become very aware of passers-by looking at them and are clearly looking at the camera, which, of course, is one of the rule-breaking of the film because it's Godard saying, I don't care. Normally, you shouldn't have people looking at the camera, but you see passers-by, you know, looking at the characters and so on.
In your eyes, when you were saying, when you watch it again and again, I got the sense you really watch this again and again. What's your count?
Well, I've lost count, actually. but I have watched it many times for pleasure. I've also watched it many times for work, for writing. I teach a New Wave course at King's College, so, of course, Breathless has to be
over
there.
Over 100?
Yeah. Oh,
over
yes. 100? Oh, yes.
Over 200?
Possibly.
Really? Okay.
But I never really tire of it, so you always see something different. You always see little details that you'd missed before, and it's a very pleasurable film, seeing Paris. There's a kind of documentary aspect
for me
about the Paris that has gone. And the music by Martial Solal, this is sort of lovely, jazzy score. And also it's a film with a lot of humour. I think it's a film that makes you smile.
Hélas, hélas, hélas.
Breathless, then, is also credited with popularising the jump cut. So what is the jump cut and how does Godard use it in the film?
Well, jump cut is when you have a visible disjunction created by cut where the camera stays more or less in the same position, but characters seem to jump. And it's credited to one of those inventions by mistake in early cinema where people would be filming and the camera got stuck and then you get filming again. So it looks like people have jumped 10 meters or something. And so there's a legend about Breathless, which is that when it was finished, it was too long. And Godard was told you have to lose 20 minutes or half an hour. And the legend is that he just cut any old, which is not true. It's important to say.
Print the legend, right?
Yes, print the legend. And the legend is often printed. But he did cut a number of shots, but not just anywhere, but partly to give it more rhythm, to accelerate the rhythm of the film. It's a film which is, and it feels very fast.
Yeah.
The character is on the run. You have moments when the camera seems to suddenly jump. There's a scene where Belmondo and Jean Seberg are in an open-top car driving through Paris, and they're driving on the Place de la Concorde. And Belmondo's voice is commenting on Jean Seberg's neck and her beauty, generally.
J'aime une fille qui a une très jolie nuque, de très jolis seins, une très jolie voix, de très jolis poignets, un très joli front, de très jolis genoux.
And when you watch the scene, you see that the camera seems to jump. It's almost like they film a minute that has been cut.
Yeah.
So you are aware of the disjunction. And of course, Godard did not invent a jump cut. It existed earlier. But he made a systematic use of it in the film, in some of the scenes, not all the time. So, for example, when you're in that long scene in the hotel bedroom in the middle, it's much more fluent, you know, and fluid. It's a very different feel. But when you are on the streets of Paris, chop, chop.
Oh, I still prefer the legend. I like the legend. And was there really much of a script to it? How much of this was written down? Because I read how much of it was done on the fly.
There was some script which Godard kept changing. And when you read biographies by the actors, for example, they all say at the time, they thought this man doesn't know what he's doing. They thought this would be a sort of terrible flop, and because they would get their lines every morning, you know, because things were changed all the time. But it's a very good illustration of the New Wave script that a French historian has said the difference between the New Wave and mainstream French cinema is in mainstream cinema, you have a script which you illustrate. And with the New Wave, you have what he calls a plan of action script. So there's a kind of plan, but then you're going to change it.
Yeah.
It enables you to improvise. And in particular, he kept changing his mind about the ending for quite a long time. It wasn't certain how the film would end.
Le dimanche matin, c'est le moment rêvé.
pour faire la grasse matinée. Il est quelle heure?
Midi.
C'était bien?
Yes, sir.
I mean, looking at the performance of Jean-Paul Belmondo at the heart of this film, I just wonder if you can talk to his role and just what the impact of it was.
Belmondo's performance in Breathless is groundbreaking because it's both extremely loose and spontaneous, and at the same time, it builds on all sorts of archetypes of masculinity.
Yeah.
He plays a hoodlum on the run called Michel Poicard, who kills a policeman in a kind of very offhand fashion at the beginning of the film. And then he's running through Paris and joining his girlfriend. And he behaves in many ways like a sort of typical French macho guy of the time. So, you know, he lifts a woman's skirt to see to see her legs. He steals money from a former girlfriend. He's remarking on the fact that Jean Seberg doesn't wear a bra under her T-shirt. He's kind of absolutely what we would say today, unreconstructed as a macho man. At the same time, and I speak as a feminist, I absolutely adore him in the film because he's funny. He also has an incredible physical presence. And Belmondo was a sportsman. He was a boxer. And one of the pleasures of the film is actually watching him move. He's extremely at ease with his body, and in a way which is charming rather than oppressive. It's also a fact that one can analyze Godard's film like most of the New Wave, and this has been done by a number of feminist writers, as a film which is a very masculinist film.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that if you look at the character played by Jean Seberg, you could say this is a modern woman. She wants to become a journalist. She's a student at the Sorbonne. She wants to do something with herself. And yet the film, in a way, belittles her ambition, sort of almost systematically. And when she meets another journalist who gives her a job, he immediately makes a pass at her.
Yeah.
So I think there is something in Breathless, but also in the whole of the New Wave, most of the New Wave films, that kind of course, betrays the fact that they're made by young men. And you can also see the character played by Jean-Paul Belmondo as a kind of alter ego of the filmmaker, of Jean-Luc Godard.
Godard was on a bit of a winning streak throughout the 1960s after Breathless.
Right.
Do you have any favourites amongst his later movies? Are there ones that our listeners should seek out in particular, do you think?
Well, it's almost a cliche, but I certainly prefer Godard's 60s work to what he made. Because he went on working up to, you know, quite recently, in fact, not long before his death. I'm very fond of Breathless. I'm also particularly fond of Le Mépris, Contempt, a film made in 1963 with Brigitte Bardot, because I'm interested in her as well. And I think the meeting of Godard and Bardot is absolutely extraordinary. And it's a very, very beautiful film. It's a color film, CinemaScope. But it's also a film about, it's very Godardian in the sense that it's very self-reflexive. So it's a film about so-called the end of cinema. Godard is saying cinema is dead already in 1963, which didn't stop him making films until the 2010s. But it's very typical of Godard, of this paradox of, to me, Le Mépris may be his most beautiful film. It's just the color, the music, Bardot. It's shot in Rome and in Capri. It's extraordinarily beautiful. And with it, he's saying cinema is dead while celebrating it, you know, in the most exquisite fashion. I also am very fond of Alphaville, 1965, a sort of science fiction film, again, shot on the streets of Paris in real buildings and so on. But he manages to give this feel for the future.
C'était ma première nuit à Alphaville, mais il me semblait déjà qu'une longue suite de siècles l'avait précédé. Quelque chose ne tournait pas rond dans la capitale de cette galaxie.
I think with, you know, somebody who made Breathless, Contempt and Alphaville, to me would be enough masterpieces to last lifetime.
Jeanette Van Sandeau, I mean, you've given us an awful lot of films to watch there. Just before we let you go, can I trouble you for two more? Because what we love to do with our guests on this show is we ask them to dig into the Studio Canal archives and pick a dream double bill. Yeah. So we've warned you this is coming. I'm just curious, which two films did you pick for us?
Well, first of all, I would say your archive is so rich that it was quite difficult to pick two. But I picked Le Corbeau, The Raven, a film made during the war by Henri-Georges Clouzot, 1943, and also Mr. Klein, a film made, in fact, by an American director, Joseph Losey, in the 1970s, but shot in Paris. And both are linked by the theme of the war. The Raven was made during the war, and it's about people writing anonymous letters to accuse people of something, which, of course, in real life in France during the war was something people did. One of the most shameful aspects of the German occupation, where people would write and say, my neighbor is a Jew, or, and things like that. In the film, it's slightly different, but it's about people accusing people through those letters, which are very toxic.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic film. It's a beautiful black and white, very noir film. I think one of the original film noir. And then Mr. Klein, it's a reconstruction of the occupation period.
Yeah.
And it's about a character called Mr. Klein, played by Alain Delon, who becomes accused of being somebody else, of being another Mr. Klein. And the film entertains this sort of ambiguity about, are there really two characters or is it just the same one? Again, it's a film about denouncing people, but both films are really about the impact of the war on in France, and also about identity, about who are these characters. So it's also interesting that in the 1940s and in the 1970s you have those two films, and I think two really fantastic films, really two masterpieces that everybody should see.
That sounds like a spectacular double bill. Jeanette Van Sandoe, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, if you'd like to dip your toes into the French New Wave, then you can stream Breathless, as well as other Godard favourites, including Alphaville and A Woman is a Woman, on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video right now. Jeanette's recommendation, The Raven or Le Corbeau, well, that's on there too. And the other half of her double bill, Mr. Klein, is available to buy or rent wherever you get your films. Now, for this episode as well, I also had a chat down the line from LA with film critic Drew Gregory, and she too is a huge fan of the French New Wave.
Yeah, I discovered the French New Wave when I was like 14, and I just was like a really precocious cinephile of a kid, and I would like go to the library and get DVDs or whatever, and I was so enraptured with the French New Wave specifically, and I think there is something for adolescence, just the coolness, right? Like, it's just when you're a teenager watching these people who just like seem to be filling these roles so expertly. I mean, the most embarrassing way that the French New Wave changed my life is that when I was like 14 and I watched Breathless, when I was in high school, I must have watched it dozens of times. I was doing the thing that Jean-Paul Belmondo does, the like Humphrey Bogart imitation, where he's like rubbing his lips, and my lips were all chapped because I was like trying to be a cool guy. Because the other thing I should say, because this is a podcast and whatever, but like, is that I'm trans. And so as a kid, I was like trying to be a man. And I was like, what models of masculinity work for me? And it's like, it's such a performed, over the top version. And I was like, okay, like that seems cool. All the while, like looking at like all the amazing like French women and being like, but also they're amazing too.
Your library stocked very different DVDs to mine.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, you said you found Breathless at 14.
Yeah.
So even so, I mean, there's the effort, you go into the library, you pick in the disc, which I know doesn't sound like much effort. Somewhere along the line, you've either randomly picked that or that's been curated for you. How did it come into your life?
I always was trying to see a wider variety than probably the average person of any age of mine. Like On the Waterfront and Cool Hand Luke, which also have these very sort of like
incredible
archetypes of masculinity. So it's very interesting for me to like look back on that and see what I was looking to as far as, I mean, because a lot of trans people are not on that journey, right?
Yeah.
If it's a trans girl who's more like confident in that identity in a certain way, if they're going to watch a classic movie, they're going to like want to be like Rita Hayworth or whoever. And it's like, I hadn't like accepted that in myself. So I was like, okay, I clearly am not like working as a boy. So what can I look to?
Yeah.
The sort of journey in my preteen and teen years was from exclusively American cinema to looking more at the world.
Deux, trois, quatre, cinq, six, sept, sept et demi, 7, 3 quarts. Tu es tellement lâche que je parie que tu vas sourire.
The thing I always found growing up was when people would tell me, I suppose there's still a little bit of in my head as well, when people would tell me, you must watch this and that's incredible and these are the best of all time. Uh-huh. The films almost come preloaded, almost with a feeling like they're homework, when you feel like you have to watch them. Uh-huh. And I just wonder, approaching them with youth as you did, 13, 14, could you approach those without any of the baggage that, if I went up to someone now and said, watch Citizen Kane, it's one of the best films of all time, they'd look at me, nod, and not watch Citizen Kane.
Right.
But you kind of delved in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because I was actually being told not to. Like, my friends weren't watching them, you know? Like, I had one friend who would let me, like, show him, like, weird movies, but I had a birthday party when I was somewhere in that like 12 to 14 range where I rented a projector to watch Vertigo.
That's amazing.
And in my head, I was like, it's in English, it's a mystery, it's in color. I was like, I'm hitting all the buttons. We made it 10 minutes into the movie. These children were just like chatting through it. So I think the reason why I didn't have that same sort of baggage was because it honestly was being discouraged.
Interesting.
It wasn't known enough by the people around me. It was just like strange. It was like, why is this what you're spending your time doing? So even as I was seeking out these movies that were like the best, there was still like a little bit of like rebelliousness there. And, you know, I wasn't allowed to watch R-rated movies at that time. So like, I'm probably like the only Scorsese fan who like watched Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore before like Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, and Raging Bull, because I wasn't allowed to watch them. With World Cinema, like, there was stuff that was like edgier that I could see because it wasn't necessarily rated or it wasn't thought of that way. And so I got to see like a lot of stuff that was like maybe a little bit more adult. So I always felt cool, you know? It's funny because there's still a lot of sex, a lot of talk of sex.
Yeah.
I wasn't like a particularly wild kid. So having a bunch of people sitting around like talking about sex, talking about love, not necessarily doing it that much, like sometimes, but like there's a lot of conversation about it. Mm. And that was so appealing.
Pourquoi tu veux pas coucher avec moi?
Parce que je voudrais savoir. Il y a quelque chose chez vous que j'aime, mais je ne sais pas quoi.
And did you get a sense of Godard and of Breathless soaking into your life?
It did like make an impact in the sense that I just desperately wanted to like get out of America. I was like, I want to go to France.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was just as a filmmaker, like I was also, I think like 15 was when I made my first like short film where I like wrote a 20-page script and like hired my friends as actors and like was like very much like had people working on it and was like really trying to make it. And so the other thing about Breathless and all those early movies is there's just, it feels like you can make it, you know, like when you watch this in Kane, it's impressive and incredible. And you're like, it's so daunting. You can't do it outside of having like RKO money, but Breathless feels like, oh, I could just pick up a camera, run around and shoot, which is sort of what they did, right? Like, you know, they shot with natural light. Like the editing style is obviously influential. And, you know, we can like theorize about the feeling it gives and the freedom it gives and existentialism and all these things. But ultimately it's also just really helpful as like a child making movies to be like, oh, if I don't get the right footage, I can always just like chop it up in ways that might be interesting. And like, there are no rules. And so that was, I think, the other thing about it was that there was like a very clear musicality and cinema to it, but it felt so doable.
I've never heard Breathless described as the film to make film more reachable to a filmmaker. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I still think about that. Yeah, I mean, I still look to really all the French New Wave movies. I mean, I'm not a big late Godard fan. Like, I'm not. I have seen a lot of them. I respect what he's doing, and I am envious of people who will like claim that he didn't make his best movie until like 2001 or whatever. But
yeah,
I appreciate that he never stopped pushing and he never stopped experimenting, politically and artistically. And then someone like Agnes Varda, I mean, I think she continued to reinvent what she could do with cinema, like, until her death, really. And that is so, it's so inspiring to me. So I think I look to them both, I guess, like, in what is sort of my day job of, like, writing about film and in, as a filmmaker, they're such a part of me. Like, it's not even, I mean, these things, we're talking about this, and so I'm saying these things, and it's not something that's even that conscious. And I'm realizing, like, oh, it's it's ingrained in who I am and in the choices I've made as far as like how to be close to film, how to make films, what to do when you don't have a Hollywood system behind you.
Love that.
I mean, I made like a web series some years back and we shot it in Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
And the way that we were able to do it is I stole from the French New Wave where we didn't record sound. And because it's too loud in there if we didn't have, you know, if we didn't have it closed off and obviously we weren't like formally filming there. So we did it all ADR, which is like a French New Wave yeah. trick, right? Like it's like just being like, oh, we'll just fill in sound later. And also then we have more freedom with it and can like do fun things to cover over the fact that it's like all ADR'd.
Where would you place Breathless? How would you describe it? Would you say it's a romance? Would you say it's a crime film? How would we get someone who's never considered watching it to take a look?
That's a really good question. I think like the way I would pitch it excitably would be like everything that you've watched in your, like, you know, if my friends are born in the like 80s and 90s, like the things that you watch, it was influenced by this. Like it has such, these films had such an impact. And it's so fun to get to like see that lineage and see how fresh it still feels, even though it's impacted all these movies.
Yeah,
I think like every 16-year-old should watch Breathless. I mean, maybe with a asterisk of like the way they talk about women is, you know, whatever. But like, it's both things, right? Like you do have this lead character who's like pretty misogynistic, but then you also have this woman who is like very sexually liberated and has the freedom to make poor choices, but has the freedom to be attracted to this guy who is this way. And so like I really think that like young people shouldn't miss out on seeing these Godard movies, especially these early ones.
I love how we've resolved this. How do we get people to watch Breathless? Is we're now going to pass into law a mandate that says we're going to do a sort of Logan's Run thing. Every 16-year-old has to watch Breathless.
Or at least they're given a copy. They don't have, they can make the choice they want to make. But I do just think that like it, I mean, rewatching Breathless last night, like I just felt it was one of those things where I was like, I don't know how I feel watching this now, but I can't even wrap my head around that because I turn it on and I'm 14, you know, like I still feel so excited by it.
Drew Gregory, this has been a delight. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Big thanks to Jeanette Van Sandoe and Drew Gregory. And now we move on to the part of the show where we give you the latest news from the world of Studio Canal. Now, I never miss an excuse to bring up Doctor Who on this podcast, and cunningly, I've managed this episode to sneak in another mention as well. Because earlier this year, the two Doctor Who big screen adventures, that would be Doctor Who and the Daleks and Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD, both starring Peter Cushing, well, they arrived on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray disc with gleaming remasters. For the collector, though, there's now something even more special with the upcoming release of brand new vinyl sets of both films. Now, with these, you get a 12-inch picture of the main artwork from the respective movie, 12-inch art cards, and the soundtrack from the films as well on vinyl record is included. Each individual set is rounded off with the 4K disc itself and a Blu-ray on top of that, and both go on sale from the end of October.
Wait.
What is it?
Listen. It's coming from over there.
Also available around the same time, a quick reminder that Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery are doing battle in the 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray release of the much-loved Highlander. Now, it spawned a franchise, this one, which is all the excuse again that I need to roll out the "there can be only one" quote from the first film.
There can be only one.
But the original is, and even the most ardent Highlander fan would have to admit this, by far, far, far the best. Also, the Studio Canal Vintage Classics line of discs is expanding again, and there's a slice of Hollywood history arriving on Blu-ray with The Sleeping Tiger. Now, if you've not heard of this one, it's a 1954 British film noir that marks the first collaboration between star Dirk Bogarde and filmmaker Joseph Losey.
Go on, 11 o'clock, time it went.
Absolutely not, I'm having too good a time.
I'm ready for a showdown anytime you want.
Now, further down the line, Bogart and Losey would unite on films like The Servant in 1963 and Accident in 1967. But this collaboration wasn't even allowed to have both of their names on it. Joseph Losey had to take a pseudonym, Victor Hanbury, as a result of the blacklisting in the McCarthy era of American history. And only over time was his real name able to adorn the movie. Look for this one arriving on disc on November the 7th. And just as we were about to record this episode, came the confirmation that Walter Hill's cult favourite, The Driver, an inspiration for filmmakers such as Quentin Tarantino, Edgar Wright and Nicholas Winding Refn, well, it's coming to 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. Ryan O'Neill and Bruce Dern lead the ensemble for it, and we're going to be talking a lot more about this in a future episode of Studio Canal Presents.
Do you ever get caught on one of your jobs?
Hasn't happened yet.
And that's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. To find out more about Studio Canal Films and the Studio Canal Presents Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. And with that, I'm off to jump on the nearest Eurostar. You all take care and au revoir.